Thank you for visiting HawkeyeDrive.com, your stop for Iowa football, men's basketball content. I'm Brendan Stiles, and welcome to our ninth edition this season of the Talking Hawks podcast exclusively on HawkeyeDrive.com. As always, every week, I'm joined by former Iowa defensive back Chris Rowell. And Chris, I give you credit. You were right. I was wrong, and I'll take my curl on this. I did not think that Iowa was going to be able to go into Michigan State and win last week. And for about 3.5 quarters, that game went about exactly the way I thought it might. And then things kind of changed. Iowa managed to tie the game. They get it to double overtime, come away with a victory at Spartan Stadium. And now they're sitting at 4-2 overall. And more importantly for the Hawkeyes, 2-0. In the Big Ten, your thoughts on what you saw last Saturday?
My thoughts of what I saw on Saturday is pretty much what I thought it would be. We're pretty much Michigan State just manhandled us for the most part, and we're just sitting here weathering the storm. Just like I told you, Maxwell was going to make a big mistake at some point, and it came at a very, very critical moment at the end of the game. Also, they didn't have their tight end, their big playmaker, so for the most part, their receivers didn't make many plays, but they made enough plays to put them in a position to actually won the game this past weekend, but they pretty much unraveled. Our defense played tough like I thought it would be. Our offense, you know, we got down the field here and there. We just couldn't punch the ball in. And what Mark Wiseman did is what I thought he was going to do, but I thought Michigan State's defense was really going to give it to us in the run game, and they pretty much knew when Mark Wiseman was getting the ball. Our offense, we dropped a couple passes. Defense, we missed a couple tackles, but at the same time, we played a pretty much of a full game, a game where you sit there and say, this is a very inspiring team right now.
This is what I kind of took away from it here. First of all, I don't want to take anything away from Iowa because they were able to come away with a victory. But I also felt like Michigan State blew some gigantic opportunities in this game. I mean, you think back to the very first drive, and I believe it was the second play from scrimmage. Michigan State dropped a pick six. Like, Vandenberg threw it right to him. Guy dropped an easy pick six, had nothing but green in front of him. Now, they were able to get an interception a couple plays later off a tip ball, and then had a short field to work with. Le'Veon Bell scored. That was kind of when I was saying, okay, Michigan State might jump out to a lead early, and it's the defense, you know, keeping them in it, which they were able to do, but the offense I don't know if it was Russ because it was the bye week the week before or the fact that they were going up against Michigan State's defense, but they really could not generate anything. I mean, you mentioned Weissman having a big game. He did break off a couple big runs there in the second half, but to me, the first half, they just couldn't move the ball. And Michigan State as well, I go back to like their whole thing with missed opportunities. You think back to the end of the first half, and they were trying to run a two-minute drill there at the end. They had the timeouts to their advantage, but then they were using them. And before you know it, they couldn't get a field goal off, and they weren't able to come away with points where if they get a field goal there, the way things ended up unfolding, instead of Iowa only being down 7 late in the game, they would have been down 10. And I don't know if that would have been enough. But I think, too, everyone's going to talk about the catch that Keenan Davis made. That was huge. And Weissman, his run on third down on that drive, and then the touchdown he scored. But to me, there were two big plays in this game that I don't know if they're getting enough attention. One is after Michigan State got what I felt might have been the backbreaking play that I alluded to last week, where they had a big reception when they had a four-point lead and got into field goal range, Iowa's defense held them to 3. If they give up a touchdown there and Michigan State goes up by 11, I feel like the game would have been over. Instead, the Spartans can only get a field goal. It's 13-6, and then that sets up that drive where you had Keenan making that huge catch, and you had Weissman's runs, and they were able. And Iowa was able to tie the game in the final minute. The other big play that I felt happened that I don't know if it's getting enough credit is in that second overtime, right before Meyer comes out and nails the 42-yard field goal to give Iowa the lead. Vandenberg threw what ended up being a sure interception, and Jordan Cotton knocked the ball away on third down. And the reason that I feel that was significant is if that is an interception, if Michigan State comes away with a turnover there, they're not even in a position where they're going to throw the football with their possession in overtime. And therefore, you're not going to get that interception from Greg Castillo. Instead, they're going to run Le'Veon Bell 3 times. If he doesn't get the first down, then they're going to just kick the field goal on fourth down. So, to me, I think those are the two kind of unheralded moments that really kind of sparked this team. And then, of course, obviously you did have that big catch by Keenan, and that was kind of when you sensed the offense maybe finally starting to figure some things out.
Yeah, I was going to iterate on Jordan's his defensive play. The biggest thing is when you see a ball that's thrown, you know, out of the area or where a defensive back has a chance to sit there and make a play, you have to turn to a defensive back as a receiver where you don't want to give the ball up, and that was a huge play by him. But like you say, the game was a sloppy game overall, you ask me, for both teams, where opportunity were there for both teams, but more so for Michigan State, like you said. Le'Veon Bell, you know, he made plays just like Mark Mizman. It came down to the defense, and our defense kept bending and bending and bending and didn't break really at all. When people were really looking for our defense to sit there and break, like you say, where we made them settle for three.
And, you know, when you talk about Iowa's defense and the way it performed, to me, I thought the key is the defensive line. And I mentioned to you before, I thought that was one of the reasons why I thought the defense would be okay coming out of a bye week, is because they do tend to rotate a lot up front, and they were going to have fresh bodies in that moment. And I'll tell you what, in the fourth quarter, I know he didn't have the stats, but I watched what Louis Trinka-Passat was doing with the guys in front of him, and he was just absolutely mauling Michigan State offensive lineman. If he had a one-on-one, he would just bull rush the guy and then get to Maxwell. Or he was being double teamed, and therefore you had guys like Joe Gaglione making plays. He ended up with 11 tackles in that game. Or you have at the very end, his ability to get, even if it was just a finger, just be able to get a bit of a deflection on that ball that Greg Castillo ultimately ended up picking off, and that secured the win for Iowa. So you think about the way that defensive line looked, I thought that was probably the biggest difference more than anything. Because, you know, the linebackers and secondary, those guys all made plays. But the defensive line really kind of, to me, set the tone for Iowa to manage to stay in it like it did throughout the game and then ultimately prevail with a victory.
Yeah, I was going to say, without doing a lot of blitzing, our defensive line pretty much took care of business. It seemed like you had a throwback here with this game where our defensive line just raising a lot of hell on defense. You've seen guys very, very active, and I was talking to my roommate and saying, hey, man, this Louis Trinka-Passat guy is just giving those guys a lot of blues, and he's back there. You know, he's making a name for himself, and he's back there just saying, hey, I'm putting a lot of pressure on this quarterback. Defensive backs, just hold off, make some plays back there, and we got it.
And, you know, it's funny that you say he's making a name for himself, because Tuesday, you know, you get a chance. All four defensive linemen, at least the guys who start regularly and play the most snaps, they were all there on Tuesday for interviews. And I asked Dominic Alves, okay, how would you describe the progress that you guys have made from, say, the beginning of the season till now? And he just said, yeah, we're all still kind of viewed as a bunch of no-names. And he described the whole group as junkyard dogs, just saying, hey, we're just going to work. And we all just have a mindset of just being able to do our job. And ultimately, I think that comes down to Reese Morgan and just the difference that's made with him taking over as the defensive line coach.
Oh, yeah. I was going to say, with Coach Morgan taking over a defensive line, it comes down to the X's and O's with him.
Right.
He told the guys, you know, that the gameplay would be there, you know, when you go on field and practice and things like that, you get the reps. But when you're sitting here and you're in a classroom, Coach Morgan is going to sit there and tell you X's and O's, hey, take down this note where you need to improve on or where you have weaknesses and so on. I think that's the key part of what has really been helping our defensive line, when a lot of people are sitting here scratching their heads about Coach Morgan getting hired as a defensive line coach. Coach Katz, he had a lot of fire. He was a guy on the field. He was an on-field guy, but he'd chew you out in a classroom. But the biggest thing now is a lot of people starting to get a lot of confidence to be able to go out there on the field and be able to execute the game plan and things like that. So, like you say, I mean, guys are making plays. Those guys have names. Let's not forget about it. Guys know who they are, but the biggest thing, like you said, they're junkyard dogs going out there just trying to give our defense a chance to sit there and make plays and get a three and out.
Now, looking at the offense, what were your thoughts on what you saw out of James Vandenberg? Because obviously he didn't have that great of a game, but after the game, Ferentz was saying, hey, you know what? A lot of what happened there at the end came because of the leadership that James Vandenberg provided. So, on one hand, it's kind of like I don't want to say a twofold thing, but you can tell the coaches and the team have confidence in him, but statistically, maybe those things just aren't showing up. I guess where do you kind of stand on that?
I would compare this a tad bit to where Ricky stands, where his junior year where he was just throwing a lot of interceptions, where it just came to a point where it was just like, oh, gosh, this guy, the fans get frustrated and things like that. James Vandenberg just can't connect with his receivers and tight ends and things like that, and it gets frustrating because he might overthrow a guy, underthrow, hold the ball too long or something like
that. Or the thing that I notice a lot of Iowa fans being upset about throughout the game, just following on Twitter, is third downs, how it could be like third and 10 and they're only getting 5 yards. Or if it's like third and 7, they're only getting 3 yards.
Yeah, I was getting ready to say that. The short game, it's frustrating when you sit here seeing a quarterback throw for 3 yards or 5 yards when you still have another 5 or 3 more yards to go, and you throw an under and you have the defenses right there pretty much sitting in zone defense just waiting on you to just throw the ball. And it's frustrating. It's very frustrating to see James throw these passes and you're sitting here scratching your head like, wow, we might as well should have just went on and ran draw, or either have Ken O'Keefe back here. And fans are starting to see why Davis was pretty much chased out of Texas, where we're not really challenging anyone, you know, where you're mid to deep range with the passes. The question is, how come we're not challenging these guys at all? We know that, yes, sometimes you make shorter routes to sit there and get a catch and go. But the thing is just it comes down to we're checking down way too much, and also starting to get very predictable here.
Well, in what ways would you say they're becoming predictable? Because I don't disagree with what you're saying there. I do notice some tendencies as well, and I think everybody's picked up on some of the tendencies. But just what are some of the things that maybe you see that an average person like myself or just whoever maybe wouldn't catch?
I would say that it just comes down to us just trying to get a catch and go, trying to get these routes, the combination routes, to where we get the guy, a receiver run off, a defensive back in, have another guy come right under, and it seems like it's just not working, or either the pass rush is just on us, and it just comes down to a point where, like, all right, I was not really sitting here challenging anyone deep at all. You know, the receivers, do they have the ability to do that? Maybe, maybe not. Keenan has the but Keenan's pretty much checked. I mean, he's locked down for the most part. You have Martin Manley. He's pretty much in the slot where most guys are going to pay attention to him because he makes a killing in the slot. But then you have Jordan Cotton, you have Don Shumpert. Those guys, they need to step up. And I know Jordan Cotton has made a lot of plays going deep and things like that. But now it comes to where, like, hey, I need to catch this ball a third down. And then you need CJ to come along. I don't know, is it him blocking a lot? Is it him not being focused and things like that? But it just comes down to we need our playmakers to make plays on third down.
And the one thing I noticed too, especially early on in the game, is they ran a lot more of a spread attack there. It is particularly in the first half, you saw a lot of situations where they were lined up in the shotgun and they had three wide, and then they have Weissman back there with Vandenberg, and then you'd have Fedorowicz up along the line with the O lineman. But the other thing I noticed too is just there were instances where they got near the goal line and then they start going five wide. And I mean, I don't know if that's necessarily something that you want to be doing right there, especially when you have a guy like Weissman. I would think at that point in time, you'd want to just pound the ball. I thought the one play where they had to settle for a field goal late, Vandenberg, they threw the ball to Fedorowicz on third down. I thought that was the right idea, but he didn't get enough on that throw, and it ended up getting batted away. I don't know. Like, I feel like they know where they need to go with the football, but it's just maybe it's the scheme or the personnel at that point in time as far as when they're doing it and how they're going about it.
Yeah, I was
going
to say it comes down to execution at the end of the day. Another thing I was going to sit here and talk to you about, and I know you brought this up last week, was the no huddle. I told you that with a team like Michigan State, it'd be tough to try to do that no huddle. We did it a little bit, but at the same time, you can't sit there and experiment with a veteran team. A veteran defense like that, and I thought we did okay, but
they did it once and it was a three and out. But it was a three and out where the third down they completed a pass, but they didn't pick up the first. So part of me almost feels like if they're able to move the chains there, they're going to keep using it, and who knows, it could have been effective. But just kind of moving along, a couple more thoughts on this game, and then we'll look ahead to Saturday. Mike Meyer. Once again, named Big Ten Special Teams Player of the Week. Comes through with 4 field goals for the second time this season. He had a 4 field goal game against Northern Illinois. right now, for my money, I would say that he's the best kicker. At the very least, he's the best kicker in the Big Ten right now. I don't have a vote, but if I did, he would be first team all Big Ten for me. I don't know if he's necessarily going to be in the conversation for Lou Groza, but just when you consider what he's done this season, it's not just the fact that he's making these kicks. It's when he's making these kicks, late in games, in overtimes. You think back to the Central Michigan game. He had that 46-yard field goal against the wind that at the time gave Iowa the lead in the fourth quarter, you know, before they ended up losing that game. You just think about where he's come along this season. It's kind of remarkable because last year he reached a point where he missed a few kicks against Minnesota, and then things just kind of went downhill for him the rest of the way. This year, he's been about as consistent a player as there's been. And, you know, without him right now, Iowa might be sitting here at 2-4 instead of sitting at 4-2.
I was going to say, a lot of people sit here and talk about Mark Wiseman, you know, Wiseman this, Wiseman that. But I told you earlier today is that Mike Meyer is our pretty much our MVP this year so far, because every time he hits the field is critical. Anytime, because we don't punch the ball in a lot as an offense, and it just comes down to where, like you say, it comes down to where Mike Meyer got his head together, and it's all mental as a kicker. And when he hits the field, our team is confident. But the thing is, this year is that he's making these kicks. Like you say, they're very tough kicks. Every time he comes in, it's just like, wow, the guy is phenomenal. He goes in, make the kick, and it just comes down to where Mike is just saying, hey, we need these points because they're going to be critical. Our defense is pretty tough, and that's what you need. As a team, a tough defense and a good kicker, and that's what we have right now. And both is keeping us in the game. Mike Meyer, like I said, is pretty much all American right now, just because he's so key to this team this year. Outside of Mark, and you know, just most all players, to be honest with you, but Mike is just one of a kind.
What does that do for just the entire team in general when you have a kicker like that that just has that kind of confidence?
I think it comes down to where a kicker with a confidence saying, hey, I can pretty much solidify 3 points. But at the same time, like I said, you don't want to sit here and say settle for three, when another team is touchdown, three. Mm-hmm. You're like, oh, gosh, we're falling behind. And it goes down to where you say, Mike's getting on the field. Here's 3 points, just like Nate Caden and Kyle Slicker early in his career and things like that. But when you got a kicker like that, you feel good about yourself and your chances of scoring.
And then just the last kind of thought here on this game. We didn't really get into it last week, but since it happened, Kirk Ferentz, this was his 100th win as a head coach at Iowa this past Saturday when Iowa beat Michigan State. You played for the man for 5 years. I know you kind of consider him almost like a father figure, if you will, just the time that you spent in the program. As a former player, what did it mean for you to see him be able to have that moment where they were able to win a game like that, and, you know, to see that he's kind of stood the test of time, but you know where I'm going with this. Just like, he's still around after all these years, and he's able to reach that sort of milestone.
It's not a lot of college coaches that actually reach 100 victories outside of, you know, these elite coaches where you sit here and say they have like 200 wins or 150 plus and so on, like your Mac Browns and Bobby Bowden, where he's already gone, but you know where I'm going along the lines with that. Nick Saban's, mm-hmm. Les Miles will be up there here pretty soon. It just comes down to where you sit here and be like, this guy is a very legit coach. He know what he's doing. He's been around the program for a very long time. He plays the game as if, you know, it's one of those deals where he's a very stable coach. He's a very stable coach, and he's around the program. But it means a lot to me to see him win 100 games, just because, like I said, a lot of coaches don't even hit 100 victories. And it's amazing because, I mean, the guy lasted this long at a university. You sit here and you have up and down years and things like that. I have a lot of fans sitting here saying, hey, we don't want this guy still around. The guy has terrible teams, and when he has talent, we underachieve and things like that. But for him to still be here, it means a lot, and a lot of people appreciate that.
just looking now at Saturday, Iowa returns home. They have a game against Penn State. Penn State's coming in here. They're coming off of a bye week, but they've won four in a row after starting the season 0-2. The big story this week, and we discussed Mark Weissman a little bit, he got hurt on that play that he scored the touchdown. And Ferentz confirmed Tuesday it is a sprained ankle. Initially Saturday, they said it was just a lower leg injury. Weissman was wearing a boot. I asked him about it after the game, and he said the only reason he couldn't go back in the game there in overtime is because he didn't feel like he was getting enough power under that leg and wasn't going to be able to make enough cuts, and he didn't want to hurt the team. So that's why you ended up seeing Garmin in that situation. But assuming Mark can't go with the sprained ankle, this keeps him out on Saturday, how does this change the dynamic for Iowa going up against Penn State?
It goes down to us sitting here relying on the true freshman, Garmin, unless Bullock comes back here. I think it comes down to where our pass game is going to be pivotal and critical this week, where we're going to have to keep those guys in a mix, our running backs, and also just run the ball like we have been in the past. It's just one thing, we're not going to have that big bruising guy. Those guys going to be more finesse, more cuts, not so much north and south like Mark Weissman runs, but it comes down to where these guys have the most important position here this week, you know, playing against a very inspired team, Penn State.
Well, and just so we're clear here, Ferentz didn't rule Weissman out completely. There's still a small possibility he could be able to play. I'm guessing what's going to end up happening here is Saturday we're going to see them warming up. He'll be in uniform, but it'll probably end up being one of those game time decision sort of things. And if he can't go, then he's not going to play at all. And then you will see Greg Garmin getting the start. You mentioned Bullock. It sounds like he had a setback. Is either a setback or not. We don't know the complete details on this yet, but he wasn't able to make the trip up to Michigan State last week. And it sounds like if Garmin is the number one back, then Jordan Kanziri would be the number two back. And when you consider that this is a guy that tore his ACL back in late March, back in spring practice when he was the number one running back on this team. To see him make the comeback that he has and just rehab as quickly as he has, and just to even talk about this guy being in a position, I think that's pretty significant, and I don't think that that's something that should go unnoticed either.
Oh, yeah, I was going to say, compare him to Adrian Peterson with his injuries-wise, where Adrian Peterson is playing at a high level. It's Jordan Kanziri, Adrian Peterson, no, not by means, but it's very inspiring a team to sit there and be able to say, hey, man, we got a guy that made a lot of plays for us last year towards in the middle and towards the end of the season also. It makes you think, hey, we got Weissman, we have Garmin, we have Bullock, Kanziri now. That's four running backs this year. But it's just one of those deals where we have options at running back, and we have options in the weirdest way ever with injuries or things like that. But at the same time, with Kanziri coming back, it can possibly be a big game breaker for the most part.
And they're going to have an absolute challenge here, because I won't say Penn State is as good a defense as Michigan State, but their front seven, in particular the linebacking core, that's a pretty solid group that the Nittany Lions have. Switching sides of the ball here, you look at Iowa's defense, we mentioned how they look a lot better, and they're looking like a formidable group themselves. They got a bit of a challenge, though, here, because Penn State, while they're struggling to run the football, in the past they've always been more of a run-oriented team. This year, they've been all about throwing the ball, slinging it around under Bill O'Brien. And you notice a significant change in Matt McGloin. He's gone from a guy that looked very inconsistent at times, even last year when he solidified himself as a starter, to now this guy's leading the Big Ten in passing yards per game. And he's thrown for almost 1,500 yards this season. And he just looks like a completely different player. How much of that do you attribute to the change in philosophy? How much of it would you say is just, hey, you know what, this guy has stepped up and has become a leader on this team, and it's shown in his play?
I was going to say we lost a lot of quarterbacks here in the league in the past couple of years, and our, you know, the leading quarterbacks, the true leading quarterbacks of the league right now is running quarterbacks, through threat guys, you know, Denard Robertson, you got Braxton Miller at Ohio State, but you have this guy that's coming back saying, hey, Matt McGoran, you are our starting quarterback, and I feel with him and James, between those two, we're going to be pretty much your premier quarterbacks in the league. But it comes down to where James is struggling now, and you have Matt McGoran taking off with a pro-style offense with Bill O'Brien taking over. With him losing his options, you know, and Silas Red and Brown that goes to Oklahoma, you sit here and scratch your head like, this guy is going to struggle to have any playmakers, but things has changed with the guys. They found their go-to guy at receiver. Their running game, like you say, is struggling, but they're getting enough out of them to be able to sit here and mix it up. Yeah. And also, I was going to say, the guy, just confidence and him being a leader with, you know, all the circumstances there at Penn State right now. We can easily say Penn State is pretty much undefeated right now playing Iowa. You know, with them missing all those field goals against Virginia, and then the comeback with Ohio, it's one of those deals you scratch your head and like, wow.
See, I don't know. It's one of, for me, it was a situation where before the sanctions were announced towards Penn State in July, I felt like looking at this team that they could still be, you know, maybe a 7-win team, maybe 8 wins, because I felt like, okay, Bill O'Brien's not going to have as much pressure on him as some would think. Just you would think before the talk would have been, okay, whoever follows Joe Paterno, they're going to have a lot of their big shoes to fill. But given everything that's happened there, it's almost like, okay, it's a brand new slate for him with him in charge. And there's really not a whole lot of pressure. He's kind of playing with house money. You mentioned all the player defections that they had. Once those happened, I'm starting to think, I don't know how they're going to score the points. I've always felt that they had a pretty solid defense, and most of those guys stuck around. But you're losing guys like Silas Redd, Justin Brown. You mentioned Anthony Farrah, their kicker. I think that's obviously been the most significant loss with him transferring to Texas. They lost some reserve offensive linemen. One of them transferred to Illinois, as a matter of fact. At the beginning of the season, I sat here thinking, man, I don't even know if this team's going to score 200 points altogether this year. And that, just to give you an idea, that's about an average of 17 points a game. They've clearly shown that they could do that. But even those first 2 weeks, they struggled. You mentioned Ohio. That was a game that you felt like they would have a lot of emotion for, but eventually they just got deflated because Ohio turned out to be a pretty good team. Virginia came down to all the missed field goals. And now this team's starting to roll. I would say Northwestern's probably the only team they've beaten to this point that's proven to be really good. But even then, they found a way to win that game and get 22 unanswered in the fourth quarter. And the thing that I also noticed, too, about Penn State, you mentioned their confidence, is their fourth down play calling. They've been very aggressive this year. They're 13 of 20 on fourth down conversions. No one else in the Big Ten's even attempted 13 fourth down conversions, let alone made 13 fourth down conversions. And again, part of that is the fact that their kickers absolutely struggled. But the fact is that they've just shown an ability that, hey, they're not afraid to, you know, it doesn't matter where they are in the field, they're not afraid to move the ball on fourth down. And I feel like that's something that could change the dynamic here, because in the past, Iowa and Penn State, they've always been field position battles for the most part when these two teams have gone head to head. But now if you have a team going for it on fourth down all the time, that changes the mindset of, okay, you got to stop here. And if you do, you may have a very short field to work with, or they're going to just continue to get long drives.
That's right. And I was going to say with Bill O'Brien, like you say, he comes in this season saying, hey, I have nothing to lose pretty much. I'm going out there and give everything I got and play some inspired football. And that's what they have been doing this year. With them being able to sit here and pass the ball like they have been, you sit here and say, hey, this is something that Iowa hasn't run into yet this year, a lot of passing. But at the same time, Penn State, like you say, Penn State has some of the better linebackers we're going to see here going down the line here. Their defense is not the Penn State defensive pass, like you say, but their offense is, they have a pretty solid foundation in their offense, and Bill O'Brien's an offensive guy. And it's just one of those deals where Penn State is going to come in here with a lot of confidence. But just like Iowa last week, will we see some rust in Penn State, mm-hmm. is the question.
Yeah, and the last thing I'll just kind of ask you about here, too, and then we'll segue to the next segment. With Saturday, this being the night game for Iowa, this is a game they're doing the black and gold stripe thing like they've done in the last couple years. How much of a factor do you feel that could be just in terms of the atmosphere that you're going to have at Kinnick Stadium, knowing that this is a night game? And these teams have played, when they've played prime time, there have been some classic games. You obviously were a part of a very special one here in Iowa City back in 2008 when you guys beat Penn State. They were number 3 in the country. How much of an impact do you feel that could have on Iowa in this game?
I figure the environment is going to be there. You know, the fans are going to be there, the hoopla of all the colors and all over the place. And then it comes down to where It's Penn State. Yeah, it's always going to be Penn State. Not just because a little glamour is gone from Penn State. Penn State is a pretty tough team right now, and we just came off a huge game. So the fans is going to be there. It's going to be electric, and it just comes down to the play of the teams. And it's going to be a really good environment to be around. It's like I say, it's Kinnick. And one thing I was going to say is that it's hard for an opposing team to win at Kinnick.
Yeah. And we'll just kind of segue here to the next segment, and we have a very special guest this week. For those of you who had been following everything that's kind of gone on at Penn State over the past 11 months from the moment that grand jury report surfaced up until this past week with, I don't want to say closure, but a finality of sorts with the Jerry Sandusky aspect of things. There was one guy that, if you've been on Twitter, he was pretty much all over the scene in State College with any little bit of aftermath that was going on, whether it was the people rallying in front of Joe Paterno's house right before he got fired, or just covering the games, being at press conferences, seeing he was there when the statue was removed this past July, obviously when Paterno died back in the winter. Ben Jones from statecollege.com has been all over the scene with that. He's made numerous appearances on ESPN Radio. Really, his name has kind of surfaced as like a go-to source for everything that was going on and at that over the past 11 months and just with anything regarding Penn State football. He's kind enough to join us on the podcast this week to discuss Saturday's game. He's also been somebody I've gotten to know pretty well. I had the opportunity to meet him back in February when I was there covering basketball. And yeah, he was kind enough to join, and I hope you enjoy the interview that I had with Ben discussing the game. And when we come back after we play that, Chris will rejoin me, and we'll discuss the games on this week's HawkeyeDrive.com Pick'em. So we'll be back shortly. In the meantime, enjoy my interview with Ben Jones from State College. Welcome back to the Talking Hawks podcast exclusively on HawkeyeDrive.com. I'm Brendan Stiles with Iowa playing Penn State this week. My guest is Ben Jones, who covers Penn State for StateCollege.com. Ben, thanks for coming on. How you been?
Thanks for having me. I've been doing good. It's nice to finally get to talk football around here, so I'm I've been enjoying the season.
Yeah, and before we do, you kind of alluded to it there. Penn State did have its bye, and I do have one question for you just regarding what happened last week. You had I don't want to say closure, but a bit of a finality, if you will, to the whole thing with Jerry Sandusky, him being sentenced 30 to 60 years in prison. You look back on the last 11 months when the grand jury report first was released up until now. Have you gotten a chance to actually just kind of sit back and think about everything that's transpired and just how much things have changed for you and everyone around that community?
Yeah, it's just I've taken a few moments to sit down and kind of just think about everything. It's really just been surreal. I think that's the word that I've used for the past 11 months. It's just really surreal to see, you know, the image that everyone had of Joe Paterno and Penn State take a complete, you know, 180 in some aspects, you know, almost overnight. So it's been pretty surreal. But like you said, the Sandusky sentencing, you know, kind of takes everything, you know, moves that story forward. And until the trials for Curley and Schultz happen, you know, it's hopefully business as usual, at least for a short period of time.
And now looking at the stuff that I know you want to discuss and I definitely want to discuss, that's why I have you on, is Saturday's game. You have Penn State coming into Iowa City on a four-game winning streak after starting the year 0-2. What's your general overview of this team as it's sailed past the halfway point of its season and starting to get ready for this game on Saturday?
I think they've started to find who they are. I think you look at the first two games, are the kind of games that you might expect them to lose. Ohio was a real emotionally charged game, and Ohio was a veteran team that knew what it wanted to do and came out and executed. And that's not to say that it isn't, you know, kind of a bad loss in Penn State's eyes, but at the same time, you can kind of look over that. Virginia, the first game on the road, and Virginia's not very good. You obviously have Sam Ficken missing, you know, a boatload of field goals. Mm-hmm. But even in that game, they improved. But, you know, from Navy on, they played good football. Matt McGlynn's, you know, been on point all season. And, you know, it's hard to tell what you're going to get any given week because Bill O'Brien hasn't been around long enough to know, you know, how a team's going to play at Iowa, a place that Penn State normally doesn't perform well. So, you know, it's they've certainly come into their own as of late, but, you know, you kind of hesitate to make any broad predictions for the rest of the season.
Have you gotten the sense that this team, and in particular Bill O'Brien, have slowly become more and more embraced by the community out there?
Yeah, I think as soon as he was introduced and had a chance to talk to people, that there was a consensus that, you know, that this was really the right guy for the job. I think when everyone heard that he was announced, or, you know, everyone heard the rumors that he was going to be hired, there's sort of like a, I mean, if not Urban Meyer kind of, you know, feeling about it. But, you know, at the same time, he's been great in the community. He's been great, you know, on and off the field for them. And I think that everybody's got his back. And it's been nice to see people complain about his play calling, because that means at least people are just thinking about football now.
And looking at some of the players and the success that Penn State's had this season, I know a lot of people are going to talk about the offense and what Matt McGoin's done, and I will get to that. But I look at the defensive side of the ball in particular, a guy like Michael Mowdy. I think back in the summer when Big Ten Media Day was going on, and how he and a couple of his teammates, they went from not even planning on showing up to suddenly they showed up overnight, and then they were there talking to everybody in Chicago. And it seems like he's really just kind of elevated into a bit of a leadership role, and you're now starting to see it on the field as well. What's your take on what you've seen out of Michael Mowdy this season?
Mowdy is doing what people expected him to do at some point. He's always sort of been the next big linebacker for Penn State, the next Sean Lee or Paul Posluszny, and he's really he's battled through injuries over the past few years, and he gets out here this year and has really taken on that leadership role on the defense, like you said, and off the field with some, you know, strong comments throughout all of these ordeals. I think he's a fantastic player. You know, he's the kind of guy that everybody wants on their team. Every coach wants a coach. And I think that has a lot to do with how well the defense has played and how Penn State's managed to come together and, you know, play pretty good football for, you know, the past four games. So I think he has a lot to do with that on both sides of the ball.
And then when you switch over to the offensive side of the ball, I mentioned Matt McGoin. Right now, I was just looking at the statistics put out by the Big Ten here on Monday, and he's at just about 1,500 yards passing, is averaging about 250 yards a game, which is more than anyone else in the conference right now. This is something that I certainly wouldn't have expected coming into this season. I know a lot of people are going to look at Bill O'Brien and his influence coming from New England as a big reason why, but is there anything that you've noticed besides that with McGoin that's allowed him to maybe elevate his game the way he has, and in a way that very few, if anyone, saw or foresaw coming into the season?
I think that him getting the starting nod way back in the spring really helped him. I think that knowing that it was his job helped him, you know, stay focused on everything. And certainly, you know, that doesn't explain why he's been able to throw with such a high accuracy and average so many yards. I think Bill O'Brien, like you said, has a lot to do with that. I think Charlie Fisher needs to get more credit. Penn State's technically their quarterback coach. Mm-hmm. He worked with Jay Cutler back when Jay Cutler was in college, and certainly Jay Cutler is not your first pick of, you know, the greatest NFL right. quarterback out there right now. But, you know, Penn State doesn't have a lot of quarterbacks going to the NFL, and the Big Ten in and of itself is not exactly the cradle of quarterbacks. So I think, you know, Bill O'Brien and Charlie Fisher have an opportunity to sort of start a quarterbacking tradition here at Penn State, and Matt McGoin is not, you know, the guy that they're going to go out and try and recruit, you know, the walk-on guy from Scranton coming in here throwing it kind of wildly at times. But, you know, if they can do this with Matt McGoin, I think that every time that Bill O'Brien calls Christian Hackenberg and says, look, I know you're the top quarterback recruit in your class, but look what I'm doing with McGoin. Yeah, that's
going to
sell some tickets to State College.
And it also appears that McGoin has found a go-to guy now in Allen Robinson as well, and it seems like his emergence has kind of coincided with the start of their winning streak.
Yeah, I think Allen Robinson is a fantastic wide receiver. There was a lot of news made around Justin Brown leaving for Oklahoma. And certainly Justin Brown has good hands. He had some cases of drops, throughout last season. But Allen Robinson has stepped up nicely. He probably should have gotten more opportunities, you know, last year, and he really didn't. So it's been good to see him step up. And I think definitely McGoin having that guy that he knows he can go to has really helped his game as well.
And then the other thing, too, regarding Penn State that I've noticed is just you mentioned the issues that they've had on special teams and how Bill O'Brien's not afraid to go for it on fourth down. I believe the stat I saw is that Penn State is currently 13 of 20 on fourth down attempts this season, which is way beyond anyone else in the Big Ten right now. Just what does it say about him that he's, you know, willing to take those gambles with the guys and put that faith in a quarterback like McGloin to pick up a first down when need be?
I think some of it just has to do with how he calls plays. He's not afraid to, just go for it on fourth down. And he's admitted that he'll call plays on second and third down, already knowing that he's going to go for it on fourth down. He says it's not a surprise to him when they decide to do it, that they've been planning a little bit ahead of time to be on that schedule. But at the same time, I think some of it comes down to the fact that Penn State, you know, in terms of, like, the grand scheme of things, doesn't have a whole lot to play for. I mean, they can afford to, you know, just go for it on fourth down because they're not playing for a Big Ten title. They're not playing for a bowl bid. And, you know, certainly these guys want to win those games. And I don't think Bill O'Brien's going to go for it on fourth down inside their own 30. But, you know, I think some of that attitude comes from, you know, we're already playing with all the house cards. We might as well just go for it.
With Penn State coming off of a bye, do you feel that this bye week came at a good time for them, considering the fact that this is a team that's won four in a row, or is this something where maybe there's cause for concern about it possibly disrupting the rhythm that they've begun to develop?
I think you always run the risk of interrupting any rhythm that you have, but I think it came at a good time, especially coming back to win against Northwestern, to have, you know, their confidence at a new high, I think, on this year. So to have a week off to sort of rest up, they had some guys that had some bumps and bruises, to get Bill Belton fully healthy, you know, to work on some things to get ready for Iowa. You know, that's all worked in their favor. But like you said, you know, you don't want to do anything that's going to disrupt your flow, and certainly bye weeks have been known to do that.
And I'll get you out of here on this, Ben. With regards to Saturday's game here in Iowa City, what are you going to be looking for out of Penn State, and what do you feel the Nittany Lions are going to have to be able to do in order to get out of Kinnick Stadium with a victory over the Hawkeyes?
I think they just have to maintain the consistency that they've had over the past four games. They haven't done anything too flashy. They haven't done anything too special. They're just going out there. They're not afraid to have drives that take 6 or 8 minutes off the clock. And they're just making some smart plays. More specifically, Penn State's lost a lot of these games against Iowa because they have won the battle in the trenches, and I think Penn State's offensive line has played really well this year, especially in pass protection, and I think that could be the difference. I like Penn State to win this game. Iowa has always been a difficult place for them to play, so it's hard to say that it's an automatic, but I think Penn State comes out of here and more importantly for them, gets the win going into their game with Ohio State.
That's Ben Jones from statecollege.com. You can check out his coverage of the Nittany Lions there. And if you haven't already been doing so, you can follow Ben on Twitter. He's at Ben_Jones88. Ben, thank you very much for the time this week. And when we come back, Chris Rowell will rejoin me, and we'll discuss the games on this week's HawkeyeDrive.com Pick'em. So hang tight. We'll be back shortly. Welcome back to Talking Hawks podcast exclusively on HawkeyeDrive.com. Brendan Stiles, I'm rejoined by Chris Rowell. I want to thank Ben Jones from statecollege.com again for joining us this week to discuss Iowa Penn State. And before we get into this week's pick'em, we'll just mention that Chris and I both went 7-3 last week. Both of us got South Carolina wrong, and then the other games we disagreed on, I got Oregon State beating BYU and Mississippi State beating Tennessee. The games you got right, Oklahoma made you look really smart the way they destroyed Texas, and then the Iowa game, it was Iowa beating Michigan State.
I was going to say, well, it's just one of those deals where you have to shake up some things here and there. You've seen of late where I've been sitting here going with a lot of upsets and things like that, but it depends on the timing of the game and who they're playing, where the game is, and that's how I look upon things, especially if the team has an advantage here and there.
Just a reminder to all of you, you can participate in the HawkeyeDrive.com Pick'em as well. All you got to do is when you're on the homepage, hover over 24 Heisman Road. You'll see the Pick'em page. Click on that. List of 10 games is there. Email your picks to HawkeyeDrive@gmail.com. Remember to include a score or your Iowa-Penn State prediction. We'll use that in the event of any tiebreakers. Rob Brown, fourth time in 5 weeks. This guy's on a roll winning these pick'ems. He's won 4 of the last 5. See if he makes it 5 of 6 or if somebody can – if we can get a new winner here this week, we'll find out. But We'll start off with this week's slate of games. With a game Saturday morning down in the other Death Valley, known as Clemson, South Carolina. You got Clemson Tigers coming off of a bye week after beating Georgia Tech and essentially pushing Al Groh out the door at Georgia Tech. The Clemson's coming in. They're at home against a Virginia Tech team that, in my opinion, salvaged its season last weekend beating Duke at home because they were in trouble at that point, having already lost three games this season. And they trailed Duke by double digits early on in that game, but they were able to come back win rather convincingly. This is a rematch of last year's ACC championship game. These teams met twice last season. Clemson won both games rather convincingly, the first one up in Lane Stadium in Blacksburg by 20, and then, of course, in that ACC title game, they won by, I believe it was 38-10 was the final there. Does Clemson continue its success against Virginia Tech, or do you feel that that win that the Hokies got last week maybe jump starts them and they find a way to get it done down in Clemson on Saturday?
I think this game comes down to injuries, and the reason why I say injuries is did Clemson get healthier with their bye week? And also with Virginia Tech losing their center, that can be a big deal coming into this game with Virginia Tech being on the road here. What else I was going to say is, can Logan Thomas sit here and have a big game on the road? This guy, he plays up and down. He has an up and down season so far. Taj Boyd, can he get to his playmakers? And Sammy Watkins and the other guy that they have that's been playing dynamite this year and stepped it up big time. But I see Clemson winning this game at home, and it's going to be a very inspiring game. But at the same time, I can see Virginia Tech winning this game just to keep them their chances here in the ACC title.
I think Virginia Tech has a defense to hang around for a while, and I don't necessarily think it's going to be a 20-point victory for Clemson again, but I do think Clemson gets it done considering the fact that they are home, and really they're clicking on offense right now. We've mentioned before Sammy Watkins, Taj Boyd at quarterback, Andre Ellington, their running back, is one of the top guys in the ACC this year. I have a hard time picking against them as well, so I think we're both going to be agreeing on this one, taking the Clemson Tigers. Moving along into the SEC, and I'm kind of surprised that this is an early game, but nevertheless, you got LSU coming off a big victory over South Carolina this past weekend. They're traveling out to College Station to Kyle Field to take on a Texas A&M team that is ranked 20th, coming off a very high-scoring game against Louisiana Tech, even more high-scoring than I thought it was going to be. They've won five in a row, but jumping back into SEC play here, they're starting to get into the meat of their schedule. This is a pretty big game for LSU considering that they have a bye week coming up after this, and then they get three straight games at home against Alabama, Mississippi State, and Ole Miss. Your thoughts on this game? Do you see LSU getting out of there with a victory, or does A&M make it six straight?
I was going to say, LSU versus Texas A&M, this is a huge game for both teams. Let's not forget about that. Texas A&M, they get a big-time team coming here on to Kyle Field and LSU. LSU has been struggling on offense, and it's very noticeable. Their defense is very stout. But let's look at Texas A&M. And they have the home field advantage. They have a really good offense. My question is, can LSU score points like Texas A&M possibly can against their defense? I think that's going to be the key to the game. And I'm going with the upset, and I'm going with Texas A&M.
I'm going to take LSU here because I feel like as good as A&M's offense is, and it's talented, it's probably one of the best offenses that you have in the entire SEC this season. LSU still has a stingy defense. You saw it on display last week against South Carolina. I don't want to say that they salvaged their season like Virginia Tech did, but to me that was a huge win for Les Miles and his team. You have that momentum going on the road here. The fact that you do have a bye week coming up, I think you can put even more effort into this game than you normally might. Not saying that teams, reserve some of it, but just I think this is more of a game where you could run a bunch of trick plays and whatnot down the stretch if it is a down to the wire game. A&M obviously has shown it has struggled on defense, giving up 57 points to Louisiana Tech last week. I feel like if this game's close, I think LSU will eventually be able to make enough plays down the stretch that they can get it done, and that's one of the reasons why I like the Tigers.
I was going
to
add on, let's not forget about Texas A&M actually playing very tough at home against Florida, which
that's
is the number 2-3 team in the nation right now. So let's not forget about that, Brandon.
Yeah, that's true, but Florida did win that game. So, I mean, speaking of Florida, we'll stay in the SEC because there's a very big game going on in the SEC East involving the Florida Gators, who are 6-0. They're 5-0 in SEC play. They're number 2 in the BCS standings, amazingly. They're at home against that South Carolina team that went into Death Valley last weekend and lost to LSU. Now they got to go into the swamp this weekend. I think South Carolina is probably the best team in that division still, and I like what Steve Spurrier has in place there, but this is just a brutal stretch, and it's to the point now that like when you come off of a loss like that to LSU or that just seems deflating, and then you have to re-energize yourselves going into the swamp 7 days later, I just feel like that's too much. To me, the key is going to be if South Carolina can make Florida one-dimensional on offense. If they struggle to stop Florida's run game, then I think the Gators win this game big. If they can keep the run game in check and force Florida to throw the ball, then I think they can hang around. But we mentioned Florida's defense. It's very stingy as well. I don't see them losing this game at home. I think the Gators win, and it's going to set up a huge game next week down in Jacksonville against Georgia.
Yeah, man, South Carolina is not only going to the swamp, but they're going to the swamp stumbling. The reason why I say this is because South Carolina, they played very inspiring games the last two games. They went to LSU and played a very, very tough team at home, and that's one thing that inspires you for this game. Also, what Florida – their resume pretty much says, hey, they are the number 2-3 team in the country or whatnot. They have everything on defense, hands down. Their offense, it comes down to the quarterback play, and also their running game, just like you said. But I'm going with South Carolina just because they're stumbling. They're stumbling. And they said, hey, we can sit here and play Florida tough at home. And I was saying to myself all the last couple of days, like, hey, will South Carolina be Gator bait for the most part? Mm-hmm. And I just feel that South Carolina played well enough to win that game last week, and I feel that they're going to play very well enough to play this week and to get a win.
And just to be clear, too, if South Carolina does win this game, it basically sets them up for winning the SEC East altogether, because I believe they have two games left against Tennessee and Arkansas that are both at home. So right there, that's going to – this because this is their last SEC road game. So, this that would set up nicely for them in that sense. But I feel like the timing of this game, if this was later in the season like it hasn't been in years past when these teams would play each other, I'd like South Carolina's chances more. But just – the fact that they just played at LSU and now they got to go into Florida back-to-back weeks, I just think that spells trouble. That's why I like the Gators at home.
But the reason why I'm saying South Carolina, like at the same time, when you play on tough teams, you play them back-to-back-to-back. You see, with South Carolina coming into the season with a lot of hype, you know that they have a really good team. And that's why you want to play back-to-back-to-back games so you can sit there and be like, hey, we gotta sit here and play tough these 3, 4, 5 weeks or so on. You know, like you say, if the game was that later on down the line, it'd be pretty much an even game, maybe lopsided here and there. But at the same – I just feel that it's a good time for South Carolina to get back on the road to actually play a game.
Moving along now into the Big Ten, there's a couple big games in the conference Saturday afternoon, and particularly in the Legends division, which is Iowa's division. We'll start off with the 2:30 game. It's an in-state rivalry, Michigan State, reeling from losing that game at home to Iowa this past weekend. Now they start a very brutal stretch this week, going into the Big House to take on a Michigan team that is ranked 23rd in the AP poll. The Spartans have won 4 in a row. In this rivalry, the last 4 years they've won. But this game being in the Big House, Michigan State kind of reeling. And you consider, too, Michigan State, all the marquee games that they've played this season have been at home. And they have one win against Boise State, but they lost to Notre Dame, they lost to Ohio State. Michigan's played two marquee games this season. They lost both of them to Alabama and Notre Dame. But neither one of those games were played in Ann Arbor, and both of those teams are currently in the top five. This is Michigan's opportunity to not only put on play a big game in front of its home crowd, but to really maybe even have a stranglehold on this division altogether. And I think it's going to be a low-scoring game because these are the two best defenses in the conference right now. I see the difference being Michigan in terms of ball security. As long as Denard's not fumbling the football away like he did against Notre Dame, there's enough incentive here for the Wolverines, considering all the smack that's been exchanged between these two programs the last few years. I think Michigan has enough fire in them and is motivated enough that they're just going to go in thinking there's no way we're losing this game. I like Michigan to get it done at home and really, you know, put a staple in themselves and maybe even begin to separate themselves from everyone else in the division.
I was going to say one thing about Michigan State. They're a tough team. And just to see them win four games in a row against Michigan and you sit there Michigan just coming – they're coming off a tough victory over Ohio State last year, losing 7-8 games in a row to Ohio State. But, I mean, Michigan State, this is a huge game for them. Not only for Michigan, it's a huge game for them. They can sit here and say, hey, we're still in a mix of things if they beat Michigan. And their defense – they have a well enough defense to sit here and stop Denard Robertson. You know, you got the pass rush. You get this guy to sit there and pass the ball. That's when you're Michigan State, you're saying, hey, thank God, because this guy cannot pass at all. So I'm going with Michigan State with the upset at the Big House, and I know this is three straight games that me and you disagreed upon. I just feel that Denard Robertson will make the mistake just like Maxwell did last week.
But, you know, going off of what you just said regarding Maxwell, I have a feeling Le'Veon Bell's he's not going to get 140 yards like he did against Iowa. And even then, Iowa put up a formidable fight against Michigan State defensively. Michigan's not going to give up 100 yards on the ground to him. Michigan State's going to have to get it figured out in the air. I think a key for them as well is if they can get Deion Sims back. But if he can't go, Michigan State, I just don't see them being able to score enough points to keep up. And that's another big reason why I feel like Michigan will get it done at home. The other big game going on Saturday afternoon in the Legends Division, you have Nebraska going into Ryan Field to take on Northwestern. Nebraska's coming off of a bye week, and that came maybe at an opportune time because they got absolutely shellacked by Ohio State 2 weeks ago in the Horseshoe, giving up 63 points to the Buckeyes in that game. Northwestern coming off an ugly win of sorts, but nevertheless, it was a win on the road against Minnesota. This game being at Ryan Field, Northwestern beat Nebraska last year in Lincoln. Do the Wildcats make it two in a row, or do you see the Huskers bouncing back and maybe even getting themselves back in position where, you know, they could set up a huge showdown next week against the Wolverines in Lincoln?
As soon as you think Nebraska sat there and started turning the wheel after they made the comeback and to beat Wisconsin, they come back and lose to Ohio State the way that they did. It's a tough one, but like you say, the bye week came at a very opportune time for them, and I don't see them losing at all playing at the high school field of Northwestern at all. I know it's very distracting to sit there and not have any fans at the game, but I really feel that this is a chance for Nebraska to sit there and get things tweaked offensively and defensively to actually – and also be there, you know, make it 2-1 in our division here with Iowa and Michigan State and Michigan to be able to sit there and be in the thick of things.
I will say this. I actually think Northwestern gets it done at home here. So this is the fourth game in a row that we disagreed on. I just look at it this way. Both teams love to run the football. They've shown that they can do it. Nebraska, obviously, you have Rex Burkhead. Taylor Martinez is shown that he could get it done on the ground. Northwestern, kind of the same with Kane Coulter. He's been sort of their Mr. Everything this year. They also have Venrick Mark, who's proven to be a pretty big playmaker for the Wildcats this season. I think where this game comes down to is which team is better at stopping the run. Nebraska's not really good at stopping the run. This is how teams have been scoring on them and moving the football on that defense this year, whereas Northwestern has actually proven to be pretty decent at stopping the run game themselves as a defense. The key for Nebraska, I feel like, if they're going to get out of Ryan Field with a victory, is they're going to have to be able to move the ball through the air, because Northwestern does have a pretty bad pass defense. But at the same time, Taylor Martinez, for all the strides that we feel he's made this season, he has thrown the ball better this year. I feel like 2 weeks ago against Ohio State, he just took a huge step backwards, and I don't know if it's something that he's going to be able to right necessarily, at least not right away. That's why I feel like Northwestern's going to be able to make enough plays and be able to keep Rex Burkhead in check. And let's not forget about special teams as well. You have a guy like Venrick Mark who can be a threat for the Wildcats returning the ball as well. Those are just some of the reasons why I feel like Northwestern's going to be able to get a second win in a row over Nebraska.
I was going to say with Nebraska and Taylor Martinez making his strides, but let's not forget, Ohio State, yes, they have given up a lot of yards on defense, their pass defense, but at the same time, let's not forget about they have playmakers back there. I mean, these guys make a lot of plays in their back end, if it's on punt blocks or just making interceptions and things like that. Ohio State is a team where you can't sit there and really judged them, you know, of late. But one thing I did see is Urban Meyer had sat there and talked to his defense here of late, because this is not the Ohio State defense that we wanted to see. But I really feel that Northwestern's back seven is not as talented as Ohio State's, and that's the reason why I'm going with Nebraska.
And bringing up defense, we'll move into a Big 12 game that features probably, I don't want to necessarily say the best defenses in the conference, but as good of a set of defenses as you're probably going to find in the Big 12 altogether this season. Texas Tech coming off a huge victory at home last weekend against West Virginia, moving into the top 25. Oh, yeah. They go into TCU. TCU, I will say, did salvage their season last week, because it looked like the wheels might be coming off after they lose to Iowa State at home and everything that they dealt with Casey Paul Hall. But last week they go into Baylor, win that game rather convincingly on the road. They set themselves up, or if they do get a victory on Saturday, they could very easily be back in the top 25. Do you see Texas Tech keeping the momentum going here from winning that game against West Virginia, or does TCU get it done at home?
I figure that Texas Tech has a very good team overall. Texas Tech didn't really run much against West Virginia, because they can just sit there and pass, and they just tore apart West Virginia. But the thing was is that on defense, they just pretty much gave West Virginia – told them that, hey, you got to make plays. We're going to go ahead and let you guys make a lot of under routes and whatnot. You just have to sit there and beat us. And they pretty much beat West Virginia just like that. They gave West Virginia what they can have, and West Virginia just couldn't. They just got into a disarray or whatnot. But TCU has always played some solid offense and some great defense. And that's one thing about TCU that we known of Gary Patterson, what he has done at that program. I'm going with TCU because they're at home, and also that – I think Texas Tech might be a little bit full of themselves after that big win.
We're done disagreeing here for now, at least. I'm actually going to take TCU as well. And to me, what it comes down to is these teams are pretty even, statistically speaking, almost across the board, not just defensively, but even offensively as well. What I notice with TCU in particular, though, is you mentioned them being at home. You mentioned the fact that this is the kind of game that they could get themselves up for. And also, you look at Texas Tech, not only are they coming off of a game like that against West Virginia where they, you know, won convincingly, but they do have a game next week at Kansas State that you got to be wondering, okay, did they maybe get caught looking ahead to this, as well as, you know, maybe not getting past the thought of, hey, they just beat West Virginia. I feel like TCU, if they're going to be able to win this game, they got to be able to punch Texas Tech in the mouth early, right from the get-go. I actually do believe that they're going to be able to do that. And then adding in the fact that the game's in Fort Worth, I'm going to agree with you on the Horned Frogs winning.
I was going to say, with Texas Tech, it's just one of those deals where they just came off two extremes, an extremely bad loss and an extremely really good win at home,
right?
You know, and their loss was on the road against Oklahoma.
Although that was in Lubbock as well.
Oh, that was Lubbock. Oh, I forgot.
They just played two home games. So.
Well, that's one of those deals where we can sit here and say, hey, they played inspiring ball. But for TCU, I think with their solid foundation, with their program, or their defense has always been tough, I'm going with their defense.
Mm-hmm. Moving back into the SEC, and we're starting to get into some of the night games here. It's nice when this game is actually played on the third Saturday in October, because that's what that phrase has always been associated with Alabama and Tennessee when they get together. This game is in Knoxville. Alabama's number one in the country. Obviously, they're undefeated. Tennessee, they're 3-3, but considering their three losses are to Florida, Georgia, and Mississippi State, I mean, it's not like they're playing any pushovers here, especially in the SEC. The last couple games, they played a shootout last week against Mississippi State, but ended up losing by, I believe it was 10 points, 41-31. Alabama beating Missouri on the road rather convincingly last week. Does Tennessee pull the upset here in this rivalry game, or does Alabama just keep it going?
Tennessee has the offense to sit there and be in a game, but the difference is you're talking about the number one team in a nation who pretty much has an overall great team, you know, on offense, you have defense, you know. Special teams don't really get really tested just because they don't really have to take too many shots outside of 40 yards or so, just because their team is able to do whatever they feel and however they feel. Tennessee, like you say, they've been playing very tough. They had the offense. Last week, they just got caught behind, just way too far behind to where sit here and say, hey, we need to make this comeback. So I'm picking Alabama just because they're the number one team in the country. But let's not forget, Tennessee has played some really tough teams, and they should be able to play for a bit. And I really feel that it comes at a good time. You know, like you say, it's always the third weekend of October or whatnot, but it just comes to a point where Tennessee just find themselves outmatched.
Tennessee does have this game at home, and they are battle-tested, as you said. Those are probably the only things that the Vols have going for them. Because as much as – and listen, I've been as high on Tyler Bray as anybody when we've had – anytime we've talked about Tennessee. But I was looking at this just before we got together. I'm going to throw five categories at you here, and they're all defensive. Rush defense, pass defense, total defense, turnover margin, and points allowed per game. Alabama's number one in all five categories nationally. Not just the SEC, nationally. They don't even – they give up 181 yards per game, 126 through the air, 55 on the ground average. Number one in the country. Tennessee is not going to be able to move the football. Even though they have the playmakers, I have a hard time seeing them move the football on this team. And their defense obviously has been porous. It's shown Alabama's going to win this game big, even though it is being played at Neyland Stadium. So I agree with you on the Tide. Big game in the Big 12 here. West Virginia, they are coming off that rough loss to Texas Tech last week. They're back home. They're taking on Kansas State, who is undefeated after surviving in Ames last weekend against Iowa State. Second straight road game for the Wildcats here in Morgantown. Do you see K-State continuing its success and, you know, really putting itself in a position where if they win this game, they're almost a lock to win the Big 12, or does West Virginia bounce back and make this a race down to the very end?
What I had here written down was that I see a heavy dose of run versus a heavy dose of pass. And West Virginia comes at an opportune time. You know, you get a big-time team coming in. You get a break from teams just killing you on the pass game. And now I think the biggest deal for their defense now, the biggest challenge for them is can they get the run support to sit there and take on this heavy dose of run. But at the same time, Kansas State knows that West Virginia has been struggling with the pass defense. So we're going to get a good balanced attack from Kansas State because they know it comes down to them being able to make the plays because they know West Virginia is at home. You know, they got an opportunity to sit there and play against a top five team in the country. And also that they need to bounce back. You know, it was a really bad loss that they had last week. And also Geno Smith has to be ready for this game. And I'm sure they are ready for this game. And it just comes down to West Virginia being able to see if Stedman Bailey will be back and Will Clark on their defensive line. It's just one of those deals where if Stedman Bailey's back and he's able to make some plays, not to be step babying of late, but with that ankle injury, it's just one of those deals as a receiver. Can you make those cuts, ins and out, get a couple catches and so on? And hands down, you have the best quarterback in the nation and you have one of the better receivers in Stedman Bailey. But with Austin in that second half, watching him play against Texas Tech, it was just one of those deals where Austin needed someone else, and you see how big is Stedman Bailey is to that offense. So, but another question is, can Kansas State stop West Virginia's run if it comes down to a part where West Virginia is pretty much has a balanced attack? And the biggest thing, I think Geno Smith didn't do this week, but at the same time, they got caught down pretty fast is, can he make plays now on the run? He didn't make a lot of plays on the run. He was just sitting in the back, just waiting to just launch the ball. And towards the end of the second half, he was just throwing the ball anywhere possible just to make, looking for a prayer.
You know, I like West Virginia to win this game mainly because I do think they'll bounce back at home. Kansas State has a very solid defense and probably about as good a defense as West Virginia could be going up against, although Texas Tech obviously proved to be very formidable as well. I actually see this game coming down to the areas of weakness with these teams. Kansas State, because they run the ball a lot with Colin Klein as their quarterback, they don't really throw the ball much at all, if ever, and they're ranked statistically at the bottom of the Big 12 in passing offense. And obviously we've seen what's happened with West Virginia's defense in the passing game as well. So it almost comes down to, okay, which area is going to be worse? Is this a week where West Virginia finally is able to, you know, get some breaks, you know, going up against a passing, an anemic passing game? Or does K-State finally, you know, show some balance because West Virginia can't stop the pass? To me, it kind of comes down to that. And I also think, too, because K-State is a team that's going to be prone to running the ball a lot, I think it actually suits up well for West Virginia's defense, in particular guys up front like your brother, I think could have a very solid game here against K-State's rushing attack. And I think it's going to set up opportunities, conversely, for West Virginia's offense to be able to move the ball down the field. I think it's going to be a close game, almost maybe not 48-45 like that when they played Texas a couple weeks ago. But I think it could be a game kind of like that where it's, say, you know, first to 30, 35 points wins. And I think West Virginia will do just enough to be able to do that.
My key is if Kansas State get caught behind 14 points, that's going to be a tough up battle to fight, because you sit there and say, hey, I got to pass the ball now, because West Virginia is going to continue to pass the ball. And then next thing you know, if it comes down to a point where West Virginia say, hey, let's take the pedal to the metal, let's get the run game going. And next thing you know, Kansas State's starting to run out of time on a comeback.
And then finally, the last game before we get into Iowa, Penn State is a game that's going on. Wow, that game will happen Saturday night. Florida State, ranked 12th in the country, they bounced back, beat Boston College at home last week. They're going down to Miami to take on a Miami team that's lost two in a row, coming off a tough loss at home to North Carolina this past weekend. I'm just going to keep this very short and simple. Florida State has one of the best rushing offenses in the ACC. They have one of the top backs in the ACC, Chris Thompson. Miami can't stop the run. They are one of the worst teams in the conference in terms of net punting, which means Florida State's going to get great field position in this game. And you see how Miami's looked against other teams similar to Florida State, like Kansas State and Notre Dame, and both those teams absolutely destroyed the Hurricanes. Even though this game is being played down in Miami, Florida State's going to win. They're going to win big, and they'll be back there again on New Year's Day playing in the Orange Bowl. I like the Seminoles.
I agree with you. Florida State has won three of the last four games against Miami, and also that Stephen Morris is possibly not playing in his game. So that pretty much says, hey, that's a wrap for Miami, and I'm going Florida State.
Now, finally, Iowa at home Saturday night against Penn State. It's a 7 p.m. Central kickoff. The game's on the Big Ten Network for those of you that aren't going to be able to go to the game. Chris, both teams are 2-0 in the conference. Obviously, Penn State can't play in the Big Ten Championship game. Iowa can, and I mentioned this to you earlier, and I'll mention it here in a little bit, that there is a plausible scenario in play for Iowa to maybe get to Indianapolis. But before I get into that, I want to get your thoughts on this game. What are the things you're going to be looking for out of the Hawkeyes Saturday night? And do you see Iowa getting to 3-0 and keeping itself in position to, you know, be neck and neck with teams like Michigan or whoever wins that Nebraska-Northwestern game, or do they fall back?
My keys to the game here is can Iowa sit here and score in the red zone? And when I say score, I mean scoring touchdowns. We've been very anemic to scoring touchdowns here, unless it's Mark Wiseman, which Mark Wiseman looks as if, you know, we're going to play to the last minute here with Mark Wiseman, and hopefully he is able to actually play in a game. Also, Penn State has been playing pretty well, coming off a bye week here this week, and their pass offense is one of the better in the Big Ten. Lastly, I have Mike Meyer. He's the key to the game. If we have to sit here and score field goals, that's what we have to do. And at the end of the day, both teams are playing very inspired ball. And I'm going with Penn State just because Penn State is they're on a roll. And I'm just going off of Mark Wiseman. If Mark Wiseman actually not able to sit here and play, we're pretty much passing the game all day long. And that hasn't been our strength, and we haven't really showed consistency on the passing game.
I'll say right now, with or without Mark Weissman in the backfield for the Hawkeyes on Saturday, I actually do think that Iowa wins this game against Penn State. And I'll tell you what I see it coming down to. You mentioned Penn State coming off of a bye. You know, in one sense, that it could be advantageous to them because of the fact that it gives Bill O'Brien an opportunity to add some new wrinkles to the playbook that they haven't shown. And you can definitely see that. And I also think that, you know, it gives them a chance to just kind of decompress a little after the, because I feel like Penn State's played a lot on emotion, But with that being said, I also feel like it's going to be difficult for Penn State to bounce back, you know, and to kind of regain that momentum, if you will, playing off of that emotion that they have for the last few weeks. So I think that they're going to have trouble scoring the ball or scoring in this game. I think it's going to end up being a low-scoring game down to the very end, kind of like what you saw last week, Iowa play Michigan State. Looking at Iowa's offense, regardless of, like I said, if Weissman can go, that's big for them. But if he can't, I think Garmon will be okay. I really do. And even though Penn State's front seven has been impressive, their secondary is somewhat suspect. I think this is going to be an opportunity for Iowa to get the passing game going. You couple the fact that this is at Kinnick Stadium, you are going to have that atmosphere. And then you mentioned Mike Meyer. I agree with you in the sense that I do think he could very well be the difference in this game, especially when you consider that Penn State doesn't really have a kicking game to speak of whatsoever. They're a team that's going to go for it on fourth down. If Iowa's defense can get stops on fourth down, they're going to get opportunities to work with a short field. And in those instances, that's where the offense has to be able to come away with touchdowns. But if they can't, they do have a reliable kicker in Meyer that they can depend on. And with all of that being said, I think Iowa gets it done. I'm going to say they win this game 16-13, and I'm going to say the 13 for Penn State comes with a missed extra point. And then you have a touchdown and three field goals from Meyer, and one of those being late in the game. So that's why I got Iowa winning that. And just to go off the point that I was making here a few minutes ago, regardless of whether or not Iowa wins this game, the way they were able to win at Michigan State and the way things are shaping up in the Legends division, it could really boil down to a month from now, Iowa playing at Michigan near the end of the season, because Nebraska and Northwestern, one of those teams, they play each other Saturday. One of those teams is going to have two losses. Michigan State and Minnesota already have two losses, and Iowa beat both of them. So let's say Iowa wins four of their last six, which I think is pretty reasonable at this point. They get to 8-4. They're 6-2 in the conference. If one of those wins is against Michigan, they're going to have a tiebreaker on them because Michigan still has to play Ohio State. You look at, I mentioned Nebraska and Northwestern. They both still have to play Michigan. They both still have to play at Michigan State. So that win that Iowa got this past weekend could really be a season changer for them. And even if they aren't able to win against Penn State on Saturday, I still think they're going to be in the thick of things here as the season progresses. But like I said, I do think Iowa will find a way to get it done against the Nittany Lions. So I'm going to say the Hawkeyes win 16-13.
Like you say, I just feel that with our offense is going to struggle if we don't have Weissman. And the reason why I say it is because, you know, Garmin's a bit rusty. He haven't really had many carries really in the backfield. And Kanzeri haven't had any plays, if he even played it. And if we're just pretty much passing and passing and passing, they're going to sit there and say, hey, we're going to pin our ears on the defensive line, get after these guys. Like you say, they have a really good front seven. If the James, this is where you sit here and say, hey, James, you need to make a play. And I think that's what it comes down to, James making plays. Our tight ends need to catch. Our receivers need to catch. And like you say, Penn State defensive backs are very suspect. Our defense will play very well. I mean, they're going to play very well like they have been playing all year long, but it comes down to we need to score touchdowns.
I agree in that respect that Iowa has to be able to do that. And like I said, I do think they're going to get opportunities in the red zone Saturday night. Going off the point with the defense, they got to be able to get those stops when it is fourth down. Because, again, Penn State, they might punt the ball, you know, on occasion if they're pinned very deep in their own territory. But they've proven if it's fourth and two, they could be on their own 30-yard line. They're going to go for it, you know, because that's – as far as Bill O'Brien's concerned, they can't play for a championship this year. So what do they got to lose, you know? They might as well, you know, go out and just be as unpredictable as possible. So – and, again, I bring that up because in the past these have been field position battles, and that could change field position. And if you're not getting those stops on fourth down, then what's going to end up happening is Penn State's going to be able to move the ball, kill the clock, and it's going to keep Iowa's offense on the sideline, and all of a sudden when they are out there, Vandenberg could be showing some rust when he is trying to go back there and throw. So I think this game is going to come down to the offensive line. I think they'll step it up, just like they did late in the game against Michigan State. And I do think that guys like James will get it going, mainly because I think players like Keenan Davis and Kevontae Martin-Manley, I think they're going to be the ones, and even Jordan Cotton. I think he's clearly emerged as the number three receiver on this team, and I think they're all going to have their moments Saturday night, and it's going to lead to a game that could very well, you know, keep Iowa, provide them that momentum to keep going as they go through the rest of the season and put themselves in a position where maybe we are talking about this team at the end of the season playing in Indianapolis on December 1st. So this is definitely going to be one of those games that will go down to the wire and be one that, you know, could continue to shape the season. I definitely think last week's victory for the Hawkeyes completely changes the season in that respect. So we'll see how it all goes. That's going to do it for this week's edition of the Talking Hawks podcast. I want to thank Ben Jones from statecollege.com again for joining us this week. Chris, I want to thank you again, as always. You can follow Chris on Twitter at CRowell34. You can follow me on Twitter at TheBStyles, and you can follow HawkeyeDrive.com on Twitter at HawkeyeDrive. Be sure to check out our coverage of the game Saturday. I'll be at Kinnick Stadium providing it regardless of the outcome. And for those of you who are interested in becoming members of HawkeyeDrive.com, we offer a three-day free trial. We also have yearly and monthly subscriptions. We have $89.99 per year, $9.99 per month. Payments are recurring. It gives you access to all the free and premium content on the site. For Chris Rowell and for Ben Jones, I'm Brendan Stiles. We'll be back again next week to recap Iowa's game against Penn State and look ahead to the Hawkeyes contest at Northwestern. Enjoy the game on Saturday, and we'll see you next week.